The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I jumped the gun a little bit. I have two short announcements as well. Sorry. They should be taped to the podium. The first one, the Socialism Conference, has press badges if you want to film or do any photography. If you don't have a press badge, you shouldn't film or take any photographs. For more information about that, you can inquire at the registration desk. And during some sessions, there may be translation going on, so you may hear some light speaking within the room. If you require translation services, again, inquire at the registration desk. Cool, now I give you Phil Gasper.
Well, welcome to Socialism 2018. I'm kind of not very happy that I have to give this talk today. Not because I'm not pleased to be speaking here, but because this is a subject that really should have died a very long time ago. And the fact that we have to continue talking about it is because it is continually propagated by people on the far right, but also people who are not necessarily on the far right, but accept some of the, what I'm going to argue, are fallacies and illusions associated with the notion of race. I guess in the era of Donald Trump, it's not a surprise that there's been a resurgence of so-called scientific racism, because Trump began his campaign in 2015 by characterizing Mexican immigrants as rapists and murderers. He's repeatedly propagated the lies that immigration is associated with increased crime and that most white murder victims are killed by blacks. His former chief strategist, Steve Bannon, justified police killings of blacks with the comment, "There are, after all, in this world, some people who are naturally aggressive and violent." And he was referring, of course, to the shooting victims, not to the cops who killed them. Trump has expressed a preference for more Norwegian immigrants while imposing his racist travel ban. And he wants to move the US to a so-called merit-based immigration system, a proposal that one commentator notes is clearly animated by a concern that the wrong kind of people are moving to the US. Now, the resurgence in scientific racism predates Trump's campaign for the presidency. But his election, I think, has given it a boost at the same time as it has given new confidence to white supremacists and the far right. A few years ago, in 2014, Nicholas Wade, who was for many years a New York Times science writer, published a book called A Troublesome Inheritance, which has been called the most toxic book on race science to appear in the last 20 years. In that book, Wade defends the notion of race corresponding to, quote, profound biological differences among groups of humans. He says that human brains evolve differently from race to race, and that this is supported by differential racial averages in IQ scores. Now, his book has received scathing rebuttals from leading population geneticists and evolutionary theorists. But he dismisses the criticisms as based on political correctness. And that's the same response that Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray gave to their critics after they defended similar ideas in the mid-1990s in their book, The Bell Curve. And now Murray, of course, is back on the lecture circuit on college campuses promoting those same ideas again. Herrnstein and Murray receive support for their work from the Pioneer Fund, which was set up in the 1930s in the US by Nazi sympathizers. It's now run by a guy named Richard Lynn, who is a notorious white supremacist psychologist from Northern Ireland, who believes that when whites become a minority in the US, quote, this will entail a considerable deterioration in the quality of social, cultural, and economic life. In 2008, Lynn published a book called The Global Bell Curve, which tries to take the stuff that Herrnstein and Murray wrote about the US give an international account. So it sets out, there are numerous charts and fancy color-coded maps in this book, and it argues that there is an international intelligence hierarchy, which he claims explains global inequality. Quote, the problem lies in them. They have some deficit. Something inside them stops them from earning as much money as we do. In the US, Lynn's book was published by Washington Summit Publishers. That's a company run by the white supremacist and neo-fascist Richard Spencer. But his ideas have proved even more popular in some European countries, particularly with anti-immigrant politicians in Germany and Austria. Thilo Sarrazin, who's actually a leading, or was, I don't know if he's still in the party, I think he is, but he's on a right-wing party. He was a member of the Social Democrats in Germany. He previously served on the executive board of the Deutsche Bundesbank. In 2010, he published an anti-immigrant tirade called, it's only published in German, I don't think it's been translated, but the title translates as Germany Abolishes Itself. And it sold over 1.5 million copies in Germany. And Sarrazin uses Richard Lynn's data to oppose immigration from Muslim-majority countries on the grounds that the latter have lower average intelligence than Germany. Some Christian Democrats in Germany have proposed IQ tests for immigrants, and similar ideas have been taken up by far-right politicians in Austria, Switzerland, and elsewhere. But the ideas aren't just confined to the far right. In 2005, the Harvard professor and evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker, who is, got a huge following from the popular science books that he writes, he started to defend the view that Ashkenazi Jews are innately more intelligent than other groups. He wrote a very long piece in the New Republic in 2006, arguing for precisely this thesis. And in case you didn't know, Pinker himself is an Ashkenazi Jew. Wade, Murray, Lynn, and other much more openly white supremacist people, also the Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson, a complete non-entity who has managed to make a huge profile for himself in the last year or so, have all promoted this view since then. They see it as a potentially more acceptable wedge issue to promote the thesis of racial intelligence differences. Now, attempts to use science rather than, for example, religion or just mere prejudice to justify the claims that some groups are racially superior to others have existed since at least the 18th century. And as I began by saying, these ideas were discredited long ago. But because racial inequality hasn't disappeared, they regularly reappear in new variants and have to be refuted again and again. Some people hoped that the final death knell for scientific racism had been sounded with the completion of the Human Genome Project in June 2000, which showed that humans share 99.9% of their genes in common. Craig Venter, who was one of the key figures in the project, whose work on gene sequencing played a crucial role in mapping the human genome, announced at that time, race has no genetic or scientific basis. But because scientific racism is driven not by scientific evidence, but by the racial animus of some and the unexamined assumptions of others, those hopes have unfortunately not yet come to fruition. Okay, a little bit of history. The US, of course, was founded on slavery and genocide. So racism and racist ideas were woven into the country's fabric from its beginning. The subtitle of this talk mentions Jefferson, so let me just say a little about Thomas Jefferson. He, of course, wrote in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, but he was also a slave owner, and within a few years was justifying the institution of slavery as based on natural inequalities between the races. In Notes on the State of Virginia, which he wrote in the early 1780s, Jefferson describes blacks as having, quote, a very strong and disagreeable odor, and claims that, quote, they require less sleep that their griefs are transient and that they are, in reason, much inferior. With respect to the latter, Jefferson, Jefferson concludes that it is not their condition, but nature which has produced the distinction. Now, Jefferson didn't himself conduct any systematic research on race, so he notes that further observation and scientific investigation, including making use of the anatomical knife, was needed to confirm his hypothesis and to achieve certainty in the matter. So in the 19th century, leading American scientists eagerly undertook the investigation that Jefferson had proposed. The most famous is perhaps Samuel George Morton, a physician and professor of anatomy in Philadelphia, who spent years collecting and measuring skulls. He was supposedly had the largest skull collection in the world in the mid-19th century, and claimed on the basis of his research that Caucasians had significantly larger brains and hence were more intelligent than Negroes, with Indians in the middle. After Morton's death in 1851, his work was continued by Josiah Nott and George Glidden, who argued that supposed differences showed that each race was in fact a distinct species, a view known as polygenism. In their view, each species had been created separately by God. A few years later, after Darwin had published The Origin of Species in 1859, the argument was reframed in evolutionary terms. So the Harvard paleontologist Nathaniel Shaler, for example, argued that each race had evolved separately from different primates. Others claimed that Negroes were less evolutionarily developed than Caucasians and retained ape-like characteristics. Now, this view has long since ceased to be scientifically credible, but it lives on in popular culture. You only have to think of Roseanne Barr's racist tweet a few weeks ago to see that. And recent research by a group of Stanford psychologists found that even younger study participants who were born since the Civil Rights Revolution and claimed to know nothing of the ape caricature of blackness were swayed by it when making judgments about black people. In one study, white male undergraduates who were subliminally exposed to words associated with apes, for example, chimp or gorilla, were more likely to condone the beating of those in police custody when they thought that the suspect was black. As a recent op-ed in the New York Times points out, this process of dehumanization often leads Americans to view African American men as larger and more fearsome than they are. This pattern of misperception is troubling. Police officers are often exonerated for killing civilians on the premise that they fired their weapons out of fear for their lives. This issue famously came up in the 2014 killing of Dontre Hamilton, an unarmed black man in Milwaukee who was shot 14 times by Officer Christopher Manny. Officer Manny later portrayed Mr. Hamilton as hulking and muscular, saying he feared being overpowered. An autopsy showed that Mr. Hamilton was actually of modest build, 5 feet 7 inches tall and 169 pounds. So that's the influence of ideas that have their currency in the 19th century. By the early 20th century, as a scientific idea, polygenism was no longer tenable. But the view that the races were biologically distinct and that whites had superior characteristics nevertheless persisted. And with the invention of IQ tests at the turn of the century, the argument now took the form that first, these tests were a satisfactory measure of innate general intelligence. Second, that some racial groups perform better on the tests than others. And that thirdly, the best explanation for the differences was that the higher scoring groups were genetically superior. And versions of this argument have been around ever since, even though it fails at nearly every step. The only thing that is true is that there are statistically significant differences between the average IQ scores of different racial groups. But there's no good reason to believe that IQ measures an innate, unchangeable intellectual capacity, or that differences between groups have a genetic explanation. Now, IQ tests were originally designed, beginning of the 20th century, by the French psychologist Alfred Binet. And his goal with developing the test was a laudable one. He wanted to identify school children who were struggling and who could then be provided with remedial educational support to perform better. So he designed a series of tasks that an average child of a certain age could be expected to perform. The mental age and chronological age of the children could then be compared with the ratio of the two being their intelligence quotient, or IQ. And it then became standard to multiply the ratio by 100 so that a child whose mental age and chronological age were the same would have an IQ of 100. A child whose mental age was ahead of their chronological age would have an IQ of more than 100, and one whose chronological age was ahead of their mental age would have an IQ of less than 100. But Binet did not believe that the tests measured a characteristic that couldn't be changed. In fact, the whole point of the tests was to provide appropriate assistance to children with below average IQs in order to raise them. Nor did Binet believe that the tests should be taken as the definitive measure of a child's intelligence. Intellectual qualities, he warned, cannot be measured as linear surfaces are measured, and he said that inflating the importance of the tests may give place to illusions. As soon as as IQ tests crossed the Atlantic to the USA, the illusions became rampant. IQ was taken by American psychologists such as H.H. Goddard and Lewis Terman, two of the most influential psychologists in the first few decades of the 20th century, who believed that intelligence was an inherited characteristic that could be little changed, and that the tests were an accurate measure of general intelligence. Both Goddard and Terman were supporters of the eugenics movement in the early 20th century, which encouraged individuals with supposedly desirable characteristics to have children while discouraging those with supposedly undesirable characteristics from reproducing. And their views on IQ tests were in line with this movement. Since intelligence was claimed to be fixed by a person's genetic inheritance, the goal of the tests was no longer to provide remedial support for improved academic performance, but to direct those with lower than average IQs into menial employment. According to Terman, who wrote a whole book about this, an IQ of 75 or below fitted someone for unskilled labor, whereas 75 to 85 was appropriate for semi-skilled work. However, he warned that without appropriate vocational training, individuals in the 75 to 85 range would drop out of school and drift easily into the ranks of the antisocial or join the army of Bolshevik discontents. Okay, but do IQ tests really measure general intelligence? One problem is that intelligence itself is not a well-defined concept. Many of the original tests were hopelessly culturally biased, but even if the most obvious biases are removed, Binet was surely right that the tests at best measure one aspect of what might reasonably be identified as intellectual ability. The contemporary Harvard psychologist Howard Gardner agrees with Binet and argues that intelligence has multiple dimensions. Gardner initially identified 8 kinds of intelligence: musical rhythmic, visual spatial, verbal linguistic, logical mathematical, bodily kinesthetic, interpersonal, intrapersonal, and naturalistic. And he's since suggested a couple of other possible dimensions of intelligence. But you don't have to agree with all the details of Gardner's theory to agree with his general point. There are many different kinds of ability that can reasonably be counted as intelligence, and excelling in one area is no guarantee that someone will excel in others. Just as importantly, whatever IQ measures, it's not an immutable characteristic. In the 1980s, the intelligence researcher James R. Flynn called attention to the fact that in every country for which there are detailed records, IQ scores have been steadily rising since the early 20th century. This is the so-called Flynn effect. For instance, between 1942 and 2008, the average IQ of British children rose by 14 points. The increases were obscured because the tests are recalibrated every few years to keep the average at 100, but they indicate that the intellectual capacities being measured can be improved with changes in educational support and other aspects of the social environment. And this conclusion is further supported by studies that show that individual IQ scores can be significantly increased with the right kind of practice. For instance, computer games that improve memory. Scientific racists from Goddard and Terman at the beginning of the 20th century to Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray in the 1990s to Nicholas Wade, the author of that recent book, compound the fallacious reasoning about intelligence with fallacious reasoning about race and race differences. They argue that differences in average IQ scores between different racial groups are largely due to genetic differences. Now, no one can identify any specific genetic differences, so they appeal to indirect evidence, such as studies of identical twins raised separately since birth that supposedly show that there is a higher correlation between the IQ scores of the twins than between children who are not related. The first studies of this kind were published by the British psychologist Cyril Burt in the 1940s and 1950s. He served as a senior advisor to the British government on education policy in the post-war period. Burt's research was first questioned by the Marxist psychologist Leon Kamin. Kamin reanalyzed Burt's data in the early 1970s, shortly after Burt himself died, and found that, statistically speaking, it was too good to be true. It later transpired, after a detailed investigation by the Sunday Times in Britain, that Burt probably faked everything. There are no independent records of the twins he'd supposedly studied, and even the research assistants who he claimed he credited as working with him appear to have been invented out of thin air, because there's no records of them either. Because he was such a major figure in British psychology, he was the editor-in-chief of the journal in which these papers were published, and so there was no peer review. But it was incredibly influential on education policy in Britain and elsewhere. There have been other twin studies since Burt was exposed as a fraud, but even the best of this research is methodologically dubious, because although the twins are raised separately, they are almost always generally raised in similar social environments. When identical twins are raised in households that differ in terms of educational background and social class, large differences in IQ scores are then observed. Whatever the findings of twin studies, though, there is no reason to think that racial differences in IQ scores have a genetic explanation. In fact, quite the contrary. And here it's important to note that even if the heritability of a characteristic is high, and even if there is a measurable difference in that characteristic between groups, it is fallacious to conclude that the difference between the groups is due to genetic differences between them. For example, height has a high degree of heritability. You are more likely to be tall if you have tall parents, and short if you have short parents. But if one group of individuals is on average taller than another, the difference may nevertheless be due entirely to environmental factors. Average height in many countries has increased over the past century. Norwegians born in 1900, for example, were on average shorter than Norwegians born in 2000. But the explanation is not that there was a change in the gene pool. The increase is due to improved nutrition and healthcare over that period. IQ correlates highly with performance on academic achievement tests, and there is a well-known black-white gap in achievement test results for reading and for math in the US. With blacks on average scoring significantly lower than whites. But that gap has actually decreased significantly over the past few decades. In 1963, the gap was about one standard deviation. By 2003, it had closed to half a standard deviation. What happened for most of that time was that the gap between educational resources and opportunities available for blacks and whites narrowed. Of course, the disparities still remain enormous, so there's no reason to think that the achievement gap would persist if educational and social inequalities were eliminated entirely. Attempts to explain the black-white achievement gap by appeal to unknown genetic differences serve only as a cover for conservative attacks on programs, from Head Start to affirmative action, aimed at reducing educational inequalities, and that's clearly the thrust of, for example, the bell curve, which is quite open about ending these programs. There's an even more fundamental reason for rejecting genetic explanation of achievement gaps between racial groups. and that is that race itself is not a biological category. Despite the widespread belief that racism has existed for all human history, the concept of race is a relatively new one. The word, or its equivalent in other languages, is not found in ancient texts. It's not even in the 14th century travel writings of Marco Polo. Its first known use in English dates from the early 16th century and coincides with the birth of modern colonialism and the transatlantic slave trade. In North America, a racial codification began to be imposed in the 17th century as a response to armed uprisings such as Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia in 1676 that united poor whites and blacks against colonial elites. In response, ruling classes resorted to a policy of divide and rule, enacting slave codes to discipline blacks while conferring small privileges on poor whites. By the end of the 17th century, the Virginia Assembly proclaimed that all white men were superior to blacks, who by this time had become chattel slaves, and they passed a law requiring masters to provide white servants with money, supplies, and land when they had completed their period of indenture. The historian Theodore Allen describes this development as the invention of the white race. Allen conducted a survey of 17th century colonial records and found no instance of the official use of the word white as a token of social status before its appearance in a Virginia law passed in 1691. The point of sketching this history is to illustrate that race is a socio-political category, not a biological one. At different times and in different places, racial boundaries have been drawn in very different ways. Moreover, while the boundaries may correspond to superficial differences, skin color, physical appearance, etc., they have no deeper biological significance. As Dorothy Roberts, author of a very good book called Fatal Invention, puts it, like citizenship, race is a political system that governs people by sorting them into social groupings based on invented biological demarcations. Race is not only interpreted according to invented rules, but more important, race itself is an invented political grouping. Race is not a biological category that is politically charged, it is a political category that has been disguised as a biological one. And according to a 1997 statement by the American Anthropological Association, genetic data show that no matter how racial groups are defined, two people from the same racial group are about as different from each other as two people from any two different racial groups. Despite this, the notion of race as a biological category persists. Much medical research, for instance, categorizes people by self-identified race. Now, there are some well-intentioned reasons for this. Until the 1960s, almost all the subjects in medical studies in the US were white men. The civil rights movement and the women's movement demanded that subjects be selected from a wider and more diverse pool, in part because people who participate in the research are more likely to receive the benefits if it results in a medical advance. So today, it's a requirement of most federally funded studies that they include participants from more than one racial background and that they analyze the results by race. Including more non-white subjects in medical research is obviously a good thing, but it has had the effect of reinforcing the idea that there are biologically significant differences between the various racial groups. In the US, the myth that whites and African Americans differ in their response to the same medical treatment, or even experience different degrees of pain, is widespread even within the medical profession. A 2016 study of medical students and residents conducted by a team of psychologists at the University of Virginia found that a substantial number of white medical students and residents hold false beliefs about biological differences between black and white people, e.g., black people's skin is thicker, black people's blood coagulates more quickly. That could affect how they assess and treat the pain experienced by black patients. The researchers found that half of their sample held one or more of these false beliefs, making it more likely that they would report lower pain ratings for black patients and prescribe lower doses of pain medication. Now, because we live in a racist society, there are indeed significant differences in health outcomes between whites and members of racially oppressed groups, even when there are controls for socioeconomic factors. But these differences are rooted in systematic oppression, not in biology. Nevertheless, because the myth that race has biological significance remains widespread, research is sometimes diverted into looking for genetic causes for the disparities, rather than unearthing their social roots and attempting to address them. Even when there are clear environmental causes for ill health, as there are, for example, in the case of childhood asthma, money still flows into research looking for genetic explanations to explain why black and brown children suffer from the disease at higher rates than their white counterparts. As Dorothy Roberts notes, a chief reason why genetic explanations are emphasized over social ones is that genetic causes can be treated with a pharmaceutical product. The automatic response to disease-causing genes is to develop a drug to target them. You are just as likely to find a gene discovery reported in the business section of a newspaper as its science section. The influence of corporate profits on what is researched and how the results are interpreted is further accentuated by the interest of pharmaceutical companies marketing race-specific medications. In 2005, the Food and Drug Administration, for the first time, approved a medication, the heart drug Bidil, B-I-D-I-L, goodness knows why it's got that name, but that's what it is, for use specifically by African Americans, even though there was no serious evidence that it had any racially disparate effects. Bidil, which was simply a combination of two other drugs, which are widely available in generic form, was a commercial failure, but the door was opened for more drugs to be marketed on the basis of race. The idea that race is biological has also been promoted by people who confuse ancestry with race, including by those who should know a lot better. Earlier this year, for instance, the Harvard geneticist David Reich published an article in the New York Times called How Genetics is Changing Our Understanding of Race, and this gave a further boost to the scientific racists. Reich is one of the world's leading experts on ancient DNA. According to a lengthy profile of him, they published a lengthy profile of him 1 week, and then a few days later he was given this big op-ed in the Sunday New York Times. According to the profile, Reich's laboratory has published DNA from the genomes of 938 ancient humans, more than all other research teams working in the field combined. The work in his lab has reshaped our understanding of human prehistory. Now, analyzing the DNA of our ancestors provides invaluable insight into their likely migratory patterns and evolution. Reich's work related to paleoanthropology is pathbreaking and invaluable, but unfortunately, the same cannot be said of his views about race. Reich, who is also incidentally the son of the first director of the Holocaust Memorial Museum, concedes that race is a social construct and accepts that in terms of genetics, human populations are extremely similar. He also expresses deep sympathy for the concern that genetic discoveries could be misused to justify racism. But Reich rejects the view that the average genetic differences among people grouped according to today's racial terms are so trivial when it comes to any meaningful biological traits that those differences can be ignored, which he claims has become a new orthodoxy. So having first agreed that race is socially constructed, Reich immediately takes it back by claiming that there are significant biological differences between different racial groups. In fact, the evidence from genetics confirms what we know from anthropology and paleontology. We are all African. Modern humans evolved in Africa about 200,000 years ago, and then about 65,000 to 70,000 years ago, groups of humans began to migrate out of Africa in successive waves, first to what is now the Middle East, then to Asia and Europe, and eventually reaching North and South America. Since the migrating groups were subpopulations of the whole, they contained less genetic diversity than the original population. New genetic variants have since arisen in the populations that left Africa. But since our species lived in Africa for the first two-thirds of its existence, and since humans spread slowly across the globe, the genetic changes that have evolved in different populations do not correspond to anything like traditional races. In addition, there's always been considerable interbreeding between the different human subpopulations. According to the biologist Ian Holmes, DNA evidence from ancient remains undermines any notion that racial categorizations, or even phrases like African ancestry, represent descent from some platonic ideal of ancestral populations. Human populations appear to have repeatedly split, merged, and interbred. And the psychologist Paige Harden concludes, ancestry allows for more continuous and granular distinctions than our relatively crude categories of race. The ancestry components that geneticists are most commonly including in their analyses are making fine-grained distinctions between people who would all be lumped together as white in the US today. David Reich is correct that genetic differences between human subpopulations may explain other differences between them. As he says, we now know that genetic factors help explain why Northern Europeans are taller on average than Southern Europeans. But the subpopulations in question are not races. Socially defined race is also a very imperfect guide to ancestry. Reich himself points out that elsewhere that 10% of self-identified African Americans have less than 50% of their genome attributable to recent African ancestry. 1 in 50 of self-identified African Americans has less than 2% of their genome from recent African ancestry. This reflects the historical role of the one drop rule in US history, which counts everyone with any recent sub-Saharan African ancestry as black. By contrast, in Brazil, you are not counted as black if you are believed to have any European ancestry. It also turns out that self-identification with any particular racial group in the US depends on a variety of other variables, including age, gender, and geographical location. In a response to Reich's New York Times article, a group of 67 scientists and researchers noted that people of West African ancestry may have higher frequency of a version of a particular gene that is linked to a higher risk of prostate cancer. But lots of people not from West Africa also have this same gene. We don't call these other people a race or say that their race is relevant to their condition. Finding a high prevalence of a particular genetic variant in a group does not make that group a race. Despite expressing deep sympathy for the concern that genetic discoveries would be misused to justify racism, Reich's sloppy use of the term race did just that. Within a few days of his article's publication, Michael Barone of the American Enterprise Institute, which also employs Charles Murray, had penned an op-ed arguing that Reich's work supports the argument that racial quotas and preferences should be abandoned. Similarly, Murray himself and the author Sam Harris, who shares Murray's views that IQ differences have a genetic basis, both tweeted the link to Reich's article, claiming it as refuting their critics. Harris, who originally made a name for himself as a leader of the New Atheist movement, has now, along with other prominent New Atheists, moved close to the alt-right. So this talk has examined some of the key arguments made by scientific racists and what is wrong with them. But as I noted at the outset, refuting the arguments is not enough. Defeating the latest revival of scientific racism will require not just good arguments, but defeating the right-wing movements with which it is associated. And defeating scientific racism at its roots will require radically changing a society that generates and depends on racial inequality.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.